I next met with Dr. Jeffrey Bradley to get an update on new clinical research developments in the use of radiation oncology in lung cancer. And to begin, he commented on an RTOG trial evaluating an increased dose of radiation therapy.
We had done a series of trials within the RTOG, and I was the principal investigator on the three trials. One was RTOG 9311, which we took patients with stage 1, 2, and 3 lung cancer, and we escalated radiation dose up to 90 gray radiation alone. These patients did not get concurrent chemotherapy, and that was in the 90s, and we encountered data emerging that concurrent chemo and radiation was more effective. So we essentially closed that trial and determined the maximum tolerated dose of radiation therapy alone was around in the range of 83 gray. Patients could tolerate that, but not in the setting of concurrent chemotherapy. Then we did RTOG 0117, and that added concurrent carboplatin and paclitaxel, and that initially was a dose escalation study trying to raise radiation dose up in the 80 gray range with chemotherapy, and we found that we couldn't get that high. We found that the highest tolerated dose we could achieve was 74 gray, and we weren't the only group to discover that. The North Central Cancer Treatment Group discovered that in their trials, and the CALGB did as well. So we felt comfortable going forward with a phase 3 trial at 74 gray versus 60 gray, which started in 2006 and just finished accrual, or we stopped accrual last year in 2011. So that's a background for the history. What happened was we accrued quite a few patients. We had 540 patients accrued, but we had an early interim analysis at approximately 450 patients or so that determined that the higher dose of radiation therapy could not result in a survival improvement on the high-dose arm. So we closed the high-dose arms of the radiation. The second question was whether or not the drug cetuximab would offer an improved survival benefit. And we continued to accrue to the trial up to for another 80 patients or so, and then closed it. So there is a remaining question whether cetuximab adds anything to chemo radiation in terms of overall survival, but we haven't looked at that data yet.
Any sort of projections about when you might be able to look at it, and any guesses about what you're going to see?
Well, that has to do with the number of events that are occurring throughout the course of the trial. And that component of the trial completed accrual, I want to say, Neil, maybe November or December last year. So it hasn't quite been a year. And we wanted a median follow-up of at least a year. So I expect that we will probably start to look at this in the November or December timeframe and break open the data and look at the cetuximab question.
What about toxicity? Do you know anything about that at this point?
Quite a bit. We've looked carefully at toxicity. One of the concerns on everyone's part when going up with 74 gray of radiation with concurrent chemotherapy was that the higher dose arm would have more toxicity. And it had slightly more toxicity, but not significantly so. There were, I think, 8 deaths on the high dose arm and 4 deaths on the standard dose radiation arm. So a little bit more, but not enough to explain why the higher dose arm did not do better. So toxicity was roughly the same between both arms.
What about dermatologic toxicity?
That was roughly the same as well. You know, there were more grade 1 and 2 dermatologic toxicities on the radiation arm, and I haven't seen the cetuximab data yet, but I would expect we would see more dermatologic toxicity in the patients who got that drug. But we haven't looked at the toxicity based on that drug yet.
What did you observe yourself and the patients that put on the trial in terms of dermatologic toxicity?
Well, we put quite a few patients on the study. I was the PI of the study, so we had it open, and I was accruing pretty well to that. And probably half of our patients, my patients, got the drug cetuximab, and the frequency of the acne rash that develops is different amongst different patients. We engaged a dermatologist early when we started using these drugs that caused acne, and so we automatically plugged them in to our dermatologist who's interested in that, and they get on a drug regimen fairly quickly. So I don't feel like the rash was that significant in our patient group.
What other trials are out there right now from the RTOG and elsewhere looking at radiation oncology questions and lung cancer that you think are important?
There are a couple of trials. One is a trial that we just opened. It's RTOG 1106, and it is a randomized phase 2 study for patients with stage 3 lung cancer that are inoperable. The patients are randomized to standard dose radiation, which in this setting is 60 gray, with concurrent chemotherapy. The chemotherapy is weekly carboplatin and paclitaxel. That's a regimen we've been using throughout our recent trials within the RTOG. And the experimental arm is attempting to intensify radiation dose. 30 fractions total are given, but after 4 weeks of radiation, the PET scan is repeated and the radiation treatment volume is directed to the residual PET volume. So the last 10 fractions is a boost of radiation to the residual PET active disease. And the radiation dose per fraction can be increased so that you can give a dose fraction from like 2.5 gray per fraction up to like 4 gray per fraction, trying to intensify that boost dose. So the total radiation dose in that arm of the trial could be as high as 85 gray. Now what limits the dose, the total dose, is the mean lung dose, because we really don't want to get into lung toxicity, and we feel a good parameter to measure predicted lung toxicity is mean lung dose. So we are keeping the mean lung dose below 20 gray in that trial. But that's our answer to RTOG 0617. Perhaps we can intensify the radiation dose by selecting patients and reducing the volume that we treat using that PET scan data.
It really makes a lot of sense. Has that been done before in lung cancer, or for that matter, other tumors?
There are a couple of groups that have done that. The data, the PI for this study is Spring Kong. She's at the University of Michigan, and she's done a very good job of data within the University of Michigan, a trial within the University of Michigan program, where they did just that. They got mid-treatment PET scans and showed that the PET activity decreased, that those were trustworthy scans, and that they could deliver these boosts, and the patients weren't failing outside of these boost volumes, because lung cancer patients tend to fail where their primary tumor was, at least in the chest. They also fail distantly, which is another problem. But from a local perspective, they fail where the tumor was originally located. So they showed that, and she's published a number of papers on that and was quite effective, and she's active in the RTOG, so we picked it up. We weren't the only group to do that. There's a group in the Netherlands that are also using what we'll call an iso-effect radiation dose, an individualized radiation dose, trying to titrate the dose to reduce lung toxicity.
I think I'm remembering also that your colleague, Dr. Govindan, had told me about a study, I think it was in EGFR mutants or maybe even other types of ALK, where there was going to be pre-op TKI given before radiation therapy. Is that happening?
That is. You know, Dr. Govindan is the principal investigator of that study from the group, the Alliance, and Hak Choi is the principal investigator from RTOG. So the Alliance and the RTOG are joining together and have proposed a study to select out patients with EGFR mutations and ALK mutations. The patients with EGFR mutations would get erlotinib up front and be followed by radiation or chemo radiation therapy, and just like that, the ALK patients would be selected up front and get crizotinib followed by chemo radiation. And the control arms of those two studies would just be chemo radiation. So we're learning a lot about lung cancer, as you know, and breaking out the different molecular types of lung cancer. We have drugs, those two drugs are available to select out those patient populations. And we need to bring that armamentarium into the stage 3 population. And so we've submitted this to the NCI, but it has not been reviewed yet.
You know, that really is just such an intuitively interesting idea. I wonder, I don't know how often this happens, where, you know, you actually have the mutation results in a stage 3 patients before treatment. Are there situations where you or you and your colleagues would do this outside a protocol setting?
You know, that's a transition type question. I'm a radiation oncologist, so what I'm told may be very locally driven. I work at Washington University with a very good medical oncologist. You mentioned who he was, and I think he's getting more and more patients tested for these molecular changes, maybe not with the intent of treating them up front with one of these drugs, but having that on the list of drugs that he could use against their cancer. And where we are in transitioning between traditional chemotherapies for these populations and targeted therapies for this population, I think may range from place to place.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, the idea that, you know, you pretty well know is very, very likely, you know, you would see tumor response, not much in the way of toxicity. It seems like it'd make radiation therapy a whole lot easier.
Well, I would look forward to treating a patient on these trials because they get a dramatic response. And a radiation oncologist is always happy if you reduce the volume of something that they need to treat. It certainly makes it much easier on the patient. It makes our targeting much easier. So I think that this trial is likely to be favored by the steering committee and go through. We certainly hope it will. We've done a lot of work to get pharma support for this trial, which is basically one trial, but it's two separate trials because the arms are kept separately. And so I think it's going to go through, and we're excited about it.
Another topic I know that I think is being looked at, or at least I'm not sure exactly how well things are going in terms of accrual, is the question of surgery versus primary stereotactic radiation for primary lung cancer. Where does that stand?
Right. So with the data that has come out over the last few years regarding stereotactic radiation therapy, that's primarily been given in patients who aren't operable candidates. They're the patients that come into my clinic and they're in a wheelchair and they've been seen by a surgeon or pulmonologist who just say, you know, their lungs don't work well enough to have surgery. So we've treated them with stereotactic radiation therapy and we've done it very effectively. They have minimal side effects and we achieve tumor control in the tumors that we treat. So we did another trial within the RTOG in an operable patient group. That was RTOG 0618. The abstract was just submitted as a late-breaking abstract for our ASTRO meeting coming up in October, and I can't say the results, but they look very good in an operable population.
So how many patients were accrued to that study?
There were about 50 patients or so accrued to that study, 50 operable patients, and these are not young, healthy people that you do lobectomies for. These were an older population. The surgeon wasn't that excited about doing an operation, but they were technically operable.
But you put patients on the study yourself?
Sure, yes.
And I'm always curious about randomized trials where the difference in treatment is pretty striking. There was a trial they tried to do like this. I think it was called the SPIRIT trial in prostate cancer. I don't think they were even able to accrue. What was it like getting consent to randomize between stereotactic radiation and surgery?
Well, this trial, 0618, was a straight phase 2 trial.
Oh, I see. It wasn't
the
randomized.
Only one arm was stereotactic radiation because occasionally a radiation oncologist would see an operable patient, and we thought, well, we can accrue to this trial just to see. We needed a two-year survival mark to aim at with the idea behind it of eventually opening a phase 3 trial comparing surgery to radiation therapy. And that trial is open. The American College of Surgeons and the RTOG have joined together to open a study comparing wedge resection to stereotactic radiation therapy for patients with peripheral stage 1 lung cancers. And that trial is open and accruing. We want to accrue about 400 patients to that trial. One of the caveats to the trial is the surgeon is allowed to decide. They do a wedge resection or a sublobectomy, but they can use brachytherapy or not by the institution, decided by the surgeon or the institution, whether or not to use brachytherapy to clear the margins, make sure they don't have marginal recurrences. But that surgery then is compared to stereotactic radiation. The population of that study is different than a couple of other trials that were attempted but have not succeeded in comparing surgery to radiation therapy. This is a marginally operable group with marginal pulmonary function. I think they're FEV1, and DLCOs need to be between 40 and 50% of predicted. So it's a very tight window of a patient population.
Yeah, that makes more sense, because when you said it was reporting, I was thinking, wow, I was amazed that they accrued, but that's the phase two, so I can understand. That's interesting. So brachytherapy with surgery to clear the margins, how often do you do that and how do you do it?
So that ACOSOG, the American College of Surgeons Oncology Group, performed a study with about 250 patients or so, and that study's been completed. Those patients were randomized. This was a phase three study. They were randomized to a wedge resection with or without brachytherapy sewed into the margins of the lobe or the wedge resection suture line. And the data had come out of Pittsburgh and I believe Brown that had showed that without brachytherapy, their local recurrences, suture line recurrences we're talking about, were in the 15 to 20% range. And with brachytherapy, they were less than 5%. So there were some institutions that were using brachytherapy in all their wedge resections. And so some of those players were key in the American College of Surgeons Oncology Group and implemented this trial, which has been completed but not reported. So brachytherapy may or may not be helpful in reducing local recurrences in the setting of wedge resections. We just don't know the answer to that yet. But since that trial had not been reported, when we devised the current study, we allowed the choice of brachytherapy to be used.
Is that a technique you yourself use?
Yes, we've used it quite a bit. We put a lot of patients. This brachytherapy study was an ACOSOG study, and our surgeons are key in ACOSOG. Brian Myers in our group was the lead thoracic surgeon in ACOSOG prior to their merging with the Alliance. So we put a lot of patients on that study. These are iodine 125 strands, the same strands that you would use for prostate cancer brachytherapy. The seed strength is less. It's 0.7 millicuries per seed. And you just basically need two strands, and the surgeon sews it in along the staple line of the wedge resection.
That's fascinating. Any other trials that are out there right now that are either waiting for events or still accruing patients that you might want to comment on?
Well, not within the cooperative groups that I'm aware of in terms of asking a radiation therapy question. There's another trial that we're still accruing to that's a trimodality study. There's a study open, it's an RTOG study, looking at patients with stage 3 lung cancer, but they're operable, and they get chemotherapy and radiation therapy prior to a planned surgery. The initial data from that was reported at ASCO last year. That study number was RTOG0229, and the intent of the study was to clear the mediastinal lymph nodes using a dose of 60 gray with chemotherapy prior to surgery. And it turned out 63% of the patients that were enrolled to that study had a mediastinal nodal clearance. And if the mediastinal nodes were clear with surgery, there was a 75% two-year survival rate with that group. So it predicted a very favorable group. On the other hand, if you did not clear your mediastinal nodes, your predicted survival was shorter. That's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. But nevertheless, we completed that trial, and we open another one that's ongoing right now using 60 gray with chemo with or without another monoclonal antibody, panitumumab. So that trial's accruing. It's nearing completion of accrual, though.
Interesting. Let's talk about your cases, beginning with your 71-year-old lady. Maybe you can just sort of briefly present her and talk about what some of the issues were.
Sure. This is a lady, 71 years of age, and I inherited from a colleague who had treated her head and neck cancer back in 1997. She had had a laryngectomy for her head and neck cancer and was continuing follow-up in our clinic. And in 2007, she was found to have a lung nodule. So she was referred to our surgeon at that time, who did a wedge resection, found cancer, and ended up doing a completion lobectomy, and followed her in his clinic for a while. And in 2010, she developed a cancer in the right lung, the opposite lung. It was a nodule, biopsy-proven squamous cell. We treated that with stereotactic radiation therapy. We've subsequently treated another lung cancer that developed this past year on the opposite side. So I have a number of patients in clinic who continue to develop small little lung cancers that we're treating repetitively with stereotactic radiation because they run out of surgical options. Maybe it's a little niche, but it seems like we have a population of patients who continue to develop these small little lung cancers, and we're picking these up by our CT imaging.
What was the histology on the tumors?
Well, the larynx cancer was obviously a squamous cell carcinoma, and the pathology from her lobectomy was a squamous cell carcinoma, as was the biopsy from, in this case, the right lower lung nodule came back squamous cell carcinoma. So they could be metastatic, but our pathologist felt like they were new lung primaries, and the image on the CT looked like a new lung primary.
And what was her smoking history?
Oh, she'd had a heavy smoking history. She quit with the diagnosis of her head and neck cancer, but prior to that, she had like a 40-pack year smoking history. So I suspect that has a lot to do with her condition now. We recently, about 7 months ago, treated her with stereotactic radiation therapy on the left side in the left lower lobe. It was more of a centrally located tumor. We had used 5 fractions of stereotactic radiation therapy, and we got a complete response with that. But in her 3-month follow-up visit, she had developed an AP window lymph node that was enlarged and FDG avid. So she had developed a lymph node. I felt like that was a metastatic lymph node. And so I did something I haven't done before, which was treat that one with stereotactic radiation, except I used 10 fractions in that one, and it cleared as well. So now she's back in our follow-up clinic getting serial imaging.
Anything out there in terms of, you know, chemo prevention? Obviously, with a patient like this, it'd be interesting, or, you know, if we could try to do something. And I know there have been various attempts to look at different agents. Anything that has looked promising or looks promising?
Not in the last several years. They were trying oral agents to prevent head and neck cancer and lung cancer, but those agents had some toxicity associated with them and the compliance wasn't very high. And so that hasn't really been a focus of attention of late. We don't really have any trials that I'm aware of where we're looking at agents as preventative agents. These patients fall out of these CT screening trials too because they've had prior cancer, and so they factor out of those CT screening trials. But I would imagine that their risk of developing another cancer is higher than what you would detect in, like, the National Lung Cancer Screening Trial.
So I want to go on to your next case, but as long as you mention screening, I always like to get people's view on that. And I'm not sure I've asked a radiation oncologist about screening for lung cancer, and I'm curious what your thoughts are and what's going on at your place in that regard.
Well, our place was very instrumental in accruing to a couple of screening trials, including the National Lung Cancer Screening Trial. So our group is very pro lung cancer screening. And for the patients who have, I believe it was a 30-pack year history and a risk for lung cancer, given, you know, the 20% improvement that we saw with that study, even with the flaws of the study, only 3 years of screening exams, that's just a huge change. We haven't seen a 20% drop in mortality from an intervention ever in my career. So that's just a huge advantage. And so I think screening is probably the most important thing to happen in lung cancer in the last several years.
I guess one thing I've been trying to figure out is the frequency of, you know, false positive screening and biopsies, et cetera. Not just in the trial or trials, but what really is happening in practice. Any sense, for example, at your place about how much of an issue this is?
It is an issue. You know, you pick up, let's say, I'm not sure my numbers will be exactly right, but let's say you pick up 10 nodules for every one you need to biopsy. And whose job is that? The patient goes to radiology and gets a screen, and the screen comes back positive. So whose responsibility is it to order the next scan and follow them? And we had established a clinic just for that patient population to try to figure out, you know, how to manage that patient group. I think it's a problem in carrying out screening and deciding which ones to worry about and which ones not to. You know, one thing I don't know much about, or I've seen research grants to try to use CT imaging to get tumor shape or spiculation, more so than what we see with the screening exams, but to use three-dimensional software to try to get a sense of which ones of those nodules to worry more about. But I think we have a lot more to learn before we implement something like that globally.
You know, I guess kind of what I've gotten out of this is that their criteria for when to biopsy, a lot has to do with growth, whether it's growing or not, at least in the trial. But I kind of wonder what's really happening in practice. You know, does everything get biopsied, or how do people decide whether to move forward with a biopsy?
We tend to use growth. And then if something gets towards a centimeter or so, getting a PET scan to get some idea of the FDG activity and a biopsy. But I think growth is the first step towards a biopsy in our center. And we typically get our scans in those types of patients about 6 months apart to try to detect growth.
So let's talk about your 58-year-old lady.
This is a lady who's under treatment right now. She's 58 years old. She comes from a few hours away, was undergoing a preoperative workup for an unrelated illness, and they detected a right lower lobe lung nodule. Where she lives, there are no thoracic surgeons, so she was referred to St. Louis to see one of our thoracic surgeons and ended up seeing our multidisciplinary team. She'd had no symptoms. She has a 40-pack year smoking history and no weight loss, but a very fit lady. She'd had the x-ray and a CT scan outside that showed a 2.5-centimeter right lower lung nodule and a subcarinal lymph node. So she came to see us. We got a PET scan. The right lower lung nodule was high. The SUV max was like 17. And she had a hilar node and a subcarinal node. We discussed her. The surgeon just still felt, given her performance status, that she was operable, but decided to do a mediastinoscopy. And basically, it wasn't a mediastinoscopy. I think he did an endobronchial ultrasound biopsy first of that subcarinal node, and it came back adenocarcinoma, lung adenocarcinoma. And he decided, based on the bulk of that node, I think it was about 3 centimeters, not to operate on her. So she was started on chemo radiation therapy. She's the first patient that's enrolled in this trial I was telling you about, this RTOG 1106, and she was placed on the standard arm of that study, which is 60 gray with concurrent chemotherapy and radiation therapy. So I think in this particular case, it's an example of lung cancer. It was silent, and she'd had subcarinal nodal metastasis. And it brings up, what's the role of surgery in these patients? What dose of radiation therapy, what chemotherapy, and what trials are available for this group?
Now, I take it she was not randomized to cetuximab?
Well, this trial doesn't use any targeted agents. It's just...
Oh, this is just the...
Chemo and radiation.
Right.
But the radiation is that PET-adapted boost versus standard treatment. And it's a randomized phase 2 study.
Right. When you have patients who are going through chemo radiation treatment, what are some of the clinical things that you do to try to support them in terms of dealing with toxicities?
Well, I think it's important to optimize their nutrition status as much as possible. This lady had had no weight loss and had no symptoms, and she had great pulmonary function. So it wasn't an issue for her. But when patients are more frail, have more COPD, we want to spare as much normal lung tissue as we can. We also want to keep a close eye on them because often they need IV fluids during the course of treatment. They need active management for esophagitis because esophagitis is a major factor in being able to deliver both chemotherapy and radiation therapy. So we try to get on top of that early, make sure they're on proper medications for that. In her case, she had a fairly small right lower lung nodule and subcarinal disease. So I know as a radiation oncologist, if I treat the subcarinal node to a high dose, the esophagus is right there. And I expect esophagitis in a patient like that. We try to minimize both lung and esophagus normal tissue doses in our radiation treatment planning. So we think about things like intensity modulated radiation therapy, limiting the target volume to just the involved tumor, et cetera.
Why don't we talk about your third patient, the 72-year-old lady?
This 72-year-old lady came to us with a right lower lobe mass that had been detected by an outside physician. And this mass was about 3 centimeters, and she had bulky right hilar adenopathy and a small subcarinal lymph node on her pre-treatment imaging. And she was very healthy, fit, good performance status, minimal weight loss. And she was, again, referred by an outside physician to our multidisciplinary team and saw our surgeon, myself, and a medical oncologist. And we discussed her in our tumor board, and we decided to offer her trimodality therapy. So what we did was we put her on another RTOG study, the one I was explaining, 0839, which uses a higher dose of radiation therapy, 60 gray, with chemotherapy, followed by surgical resection. So she went through that fairly well. She really didn't develop many side effects to the chemo radiation. She was also in that study randomized to receive this drug panitumumab, which is a monoclonal antibody against EGFR, and she received that fairly well. She did develop a rash. And then 6 weeks later, she had a right lower lobectomy and a mediastinal lymph node dissection.
And what's her current situation?
Well, the pathology in her case did not show eradication of tumor either in the primary or in the lymph node. She had residual adenocarcinoma in the primary tumor and hilar and subcarinal lymph node, so she wasn't one that got a pathologic complete response, but she did get a complete resection. And right now, I think that was about 10 months ago, and she continues in follow-up with no evidence of recurrence. She's dealt with radiation pneumonitis, which occurred about 3 months after treatment completed, which we treated with a course of prednisone, an extended course of prednisone, but she's recovered from that now.
She was smoking up until the time of diagnosis?
She was. She smoked right up until her diagnosis, and then she tells me she stopped, and I believe her, but as you know, almost all patients tell you they've stopped smoking.
How long did the pneumonitis last?
In her case, it was fairly exaggerated. She had developed it about 3 months after her resection. She came in to see the surgeon who called me to see her that day, and we saw her in clinic, and we started her on a course of oral prednisone. And normally, I like to keep them on prednisone, usually 1 mg/kg per day for, I try to get them off in about 2 weeks. But I think in her case, she ended up needing 4 weeks of prednisone, and then we tapered her off and then put her back on a lower dose. So she was on prednisone for about 6 weeks, but eventually she got over it.
Are there any questions that you receive from either radiation oncologists or medical oncologists or at your tumor board that we haven't talked about yet today?
We get lots of patients referred, going back to the stereotactic radiation therapy question. There are a number of different situations where you ask yourself, is it applicable? The trials that we've done have shown that it's very applicable for tumors that are in the periphery, that are not next to a major bronchus or a blood vessel, say the aorta or pulmonary artery. But I routinely get asked to see patients or consider that in tumors that are more centrally located, where the risk may be higher. Another setting would be a patient fails chemo radiation for stage 3 disease but has a persistent lung nodule that hasn't resolved. With standard chemo radiation, would you consider stereotactic radiation in that situation? And, you know, those are all subjects of trials. We've done a number of studies for patients with stage 1 lung cancers that are what we call central, within 2 centimeters of a primary bronchus. And RTOG has done studies as well, and it looks like stereotactic radiation therapy is applicable in that group. You just have to back down on the dose a little bit and give 5 fractions instead of 3. We're not seeing much toxicity.
I know you're very involved with proton beam therapy. To what extent, if at all, has that been looked at in lung cancer?
That's a great question. Most centers that offer proton therapy, there are 9 centers in the United States that are open and treating patients right now. Our center is the 10th and will open hopefully in a month or two. But most of them haven't looked at lung cancer. They've focused on, let's say, prostate cancer or pediatric cancers, other types of cancers. Lung cancer is a difficult bear to tackle with protons, but the group at MD Anderson has really renewed interest in treating lung cancer with protons. They've got a current randomized phase 2 trial that's open at their center, shared with Harvard in Boston, where they're treating patients with 74 gray protons versus 74 gray intensity modulated radiation therapy with chemotherapy. And they haven't released the results of that data or reported them. They've reported toxicity results, which are favoring protons, but not efficacy results yet. But they've really piloted that push for protons. You know, I chair the RTOG Lung Cancer Committee, and we have proposed a concept for protons versus IMRT that would be shared amongst all the proton institutions who are treating patients now, trying to get a trial open with NCI funding comparing protons to IMRT. And I'm one of the people spearheading that effort. Again, that hasn't been reviewed by NCI yet, but we're hoping to get such a trial open.
For non-radiation oncologists like myself, how would you explain the difference between IMRT and proton in terms of, I guess, the fields? My sort of gross understanding is that proton therapy is more precise, less normal tissue. Is that kind of the difference?
Okay, let's tackle IMRT first. IMRT is dose painting. So it's using, instead of the traditional radiation use, let's say 3 or 4 radiation fields focused on a target, the primary tumor and the nodes, and you got dose spillage, high dose spillage in places you didn't necessarily want it. With intensity modulated radiation therapy, you can use, let's say, 6 different beam directions, and the prescription, let's say 60 to 66 gray, to your target is a much tighter wrapping around that target. The disadvantage to IMRT is that you get more lower doses in other parts of the lung. So your 5 gray and your 10 gray isodose lines spread out more and treat more normal tissues. Protons, on the other hand, they have a charge and a mass. And so they, unlike X-rays, protons stop in tissue. And you can use your proton beam, you can decide you want to treat to a certain depth, let's say it's 10 centimeters, and you want that beam to stop in space. So you can prescribe that depth of 10 centimeters, the depth of your tumor, and then the normal tissues beyond that proton beam don't get radiation. So really the advantage of protons is what you're missing. You're not treating the normal tissues as much as you are with X-ray beams. So the advantage of protons might simply be that you're decreasing toxicity. In the meantime, while you're decreasing toxicity, because you're treating less normal tissues, you might be able to increase the radiation dose and increase the precision with which you're treating the tumor. So there's a push for lung cancer to be a testing ground for proving the efficacy of protons, because lung cancer is so prevalent. So many radiation oncologists treat lung cancer. It's one of the major cancers, and it's the major killer. So what a better situation to test protons.